It's counting down and are counting up your arm.
Yeah. But tonight I'm really very pleased to have Dani Onken here. She's been a real supporter of my movies for Christy over the years, and we really appreciate it. And finally, she's going to be doing giving a presentation tonight on Kabbalah and Awakening. Welcome to Many Rivers. Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, I've been a supporter for 1 year. I moved here a year ago. And one of the reasons I moved here was Many Rivers Bookstore, because of the beautiful vibrations that this store has and the access to all the mystical traditions. I'm a very unlikely person to be talking about Kabbalah. First of all, I'm a woman, and it's only recently that this tradition has come out of hiding, let alone been able to be talked about by a woman who is now divorced, not married, hasn't studied Torah her whole life. I came to study Kabbalah through the back door of healing. I had attended a healing school where one of the teachers went on to teach the path of Kabbalah as a path of healing, soul healing, personal healing, physical healing, emotional healing, and awakening. So I didn't come to it with any of the preconceptions of religion. And at the same time, you really can't separate Kabbalah from the Jewish religion. It's gained quite a lot of popularity recently, and some of the books out there are using it for manifestation, abundance, you know, this is how you get what you want. And, you know, actually, those techniques work, because the Kabbalah is rooted in very deep universal laws. But I chose this topic particularly for tonight because very few people talk about Kabbalah as an actual path to God realization, a path to awakening. And I didn't even really recognize that until years into studying it and having had some pretty deep experiences with Kundalini awakening. And I happened to have found an Indian teacher that studied Kabbalah, go figure, and in India. And he would only talk to me in Kabbalistic language, God bless him, because I began to understand through my own experiences how the tree internally related to certain awakening experiences. I thought I'd start with defining some words so that we're all kind of on the same page. But I have to preface it with saying that it's nearly impossible to give a talk about Kabbalah and awakening in 1 hour. I mean, I set the bar really high. So there'll probably be things that I don't say for those of you who are already familiar with Kabbalah. But I've tried to pick out some key things that I think are really understandable and universal so that we could all have somewhat of a discussion about it. So the word Kabbalah comes from a Hebrew root, and the root means simply to receive the wisdom and teachings of the tradition. And the tradition is said to go back to the time of Abraham, about whom we don't know very much, except that he was supposedly versed in understanding all of Kabbalah's many aspects, which included astrology, numerology, work with sacred divine names, God names, prayer, study of Torah, and Abraham was said to have mastered all of that. Talking about lineages and broken lineages, which you mentioned, the Kabbalistic lineage itself got broken with the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, when things were no longer centralized for Jewish worship and the Jews were in exile. Most of the tradition and the rabbis that held that tradition were scattered. And previous to that, it was strictly an oral tradition. And it was very hidden, esoteric, and passed from rabbi to disciple, And you had to be initiated into it, like any sacred tradition. Somewhere around the Middle Ages, I mean, it was still continued in secret circles. There's no one book called Kabbalah, even though all those books up there say Kabbalah. They're rooted in a lot of ancient texts, some of which are still not translated. They're sitting collecting dust in libraries. And mainly they're rooted in commentaries. Kabbalah is rooted in commentaries on these ancient texts. And there's no agreement about what those commentaries mean. So, you know, this is not an organized body of knowledge. It's just been reinterpreted and taken into living initiation by adepts. So when one encounters with a true heart this tradition, one encounters a living tradition, and one has to be prepared for that. So one of the reasons that in the olden times it was not taught to anybody who wasn't prepared was that it was considered dangerous, because in its practices you would go into very, very exalted and sometimes ungrounded states of consciousness as part of an awakening process. So there were, and the Jewish tradition has some rather flagrant off people that went off, sabotaged thee, and did whatever they wanted, and kind of really abused the powers that come with exalted states. So there was a lot of suspicion right up until now, I would say, especially in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. So it was purposely kept very obscure and hidden, and the language is really off-putting when you read Kabbalistic texts. It's hard to understand. And for me, some of the deepening came when I actually started to tackle Hebrew, to be able to understand some of the plays on words and the letter meditations. So it's been a long process over 15 years to try to get to the meat and the central core of what awakening is in this Kabbalistic tradition. The tradition is definitely deistic, in that God is worshipped, belief in the monotheistic God. But at the same time, you have the full gamut from the God names that talk to an all-powerful and even punishing God, to a God name that speaks of the formless God that can't be spoken about at all, the God without ends, without form, without name. So that's what initially got me interested in this topic. How does this one mystical path go from that God, this dualistic, seemingly dualistic version of God, to the formless, nameless one, and what does that mean in terms of our process with that? Let's see. The word awakening, also a pretty loaded word, especially here with all the non-dual teachers around. Because I came to Kabbalah through the work of my own healing, I was pretty stunned when I came to some of the talks in Sebastopol to hear non-dual speakers talking about awakening without any process. You just realize that you're awake and you open to the presence here and now, and you practice that, I guess. For me, that was a shock, because I'd spent years in therapy, years in psychological classes and workshops, and lots of money on that. And also, through the tradition of Kabbalah, it's a tree of life. And a tree implies a seed, and the seed being watered and tended, and a ripening process and a growth process. And I've used the word awakening very purposefully here instead of the word enlightenment, which implies something that's complete and finished. For me, awakening is like the process of a seed ripening and that's why they call it a tree of life. The tree of life, which you have a picture of, and I'll talk about in a little bit, is seen on the body of a man here. That's one version of many versions of the tree of life. I've seen trees that look like concentric circles where you just kind of penetrate the circles deeper and deeper. In early Kabbalah, the process of awakening was talked about as going through levels of a palace, like seven rooms in a palace. So this version of the tree came about in about the 1500s with Isaac Luria, who was a very famous Kabbalist. And it's put on the body symbolically. In actuality, the tree of life doesn't exist, but it's a map of consciousness that is useful to examine, to talk about the ripening process, this awakening process. Feel free to ask questions as I go, by the way. Sometimes people get a dazed look, and it's because the information goes in on this literal level, but it's also coming in with the stream of the tradition. So if you kind of lose me, just raise your hand.
Yeah. So this isn't connected with the chakra system or any of the Eastern?
You know, Carolyn Mace wrote this book about the chakra system and the Kabbalistic system and how it's all related. It is, yet it's not a direct switch.
It looks similar.
It looks similar. It's similar to what happens with the Kundalini rising, piercing all the chakras. But it has its own particular flavor, and I would not say it's a direct match. The chakra system tends to be personal to our own energy system, and the tree of life is both cosmic, universal, and personal. So, was there another question before I go on? The tree is really man made in the image of God. Like, we're all tree of life, life's walking. It's the tree is sort of the patterning, the universal blueprint for our awakening process, for our being perfected, and I put that in quotes. It's a template of divine perfection. It's also a template for how light moves, how light is channeled from the cosmos, from the source, through our personal energy system. Let's see. If we were to try to come up with a general agreement on what the definition of awakening is, I'll throw out a few words. You can help me and add some. Awakening or being awake would be the sense of an embodied connection, a sense of equanimity, a sense of love for all of humankind, maybe the lifting of the veil that keeps us separate from other human beings. Any other definitions that come to mind? Have I covered it all in three sentences?
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Expanded.
Expansion, right? Anything else?
Seeing through the trance.
Seeing through the trance. And what do you mean by trance?
I mean by the trance that makes all of this so real.
Right, that seems so real. Right. Which brings me to something I forgot to say. In healing school, my first healing training was with Barbara Brennan. We spent the first 2 years expanding the sense of time, linear time and space. And that's really the prerequisite for coming out of the trance and being stuck in the belief that this is one linear, limited reality. And then when I got to the Kabbalistic training that I did, it was the same thing. How are we going to receive this wisdom? Well, we have to be open. And to be open, we can't be in our conditioned small selves. But for me, awakening also includes conflict, fear, feeling separate, and any of the so-called negative states. And what makes it part of awakening for me is that I can be awake to the fact that I'm nervous and in fear and feeling separate. And if we don't include that in our definition of awakening, then we only have a transcendent only, you know, definition of awakening with all the energy up here. So for me, that's very important. There's a traditional Jewish teaching story that talks about a young man who was going to apply to the best mystical academy of the time, and he approaches the elder person of the academy, and the elder says to him, "My son, you know, you have the right intention, you're on the right path, I can tell that you work hard, but tell me something, have you achieved the state of equanimity?" And the man gets very thoughtful and thinks about the question, and he says, "Master, what do you mean by equanimity?" And the master says, "Well, when somebody praises you, do you feel pleasure? And when somebody insults you, do you feel pain? And are both of these people the same to you?" And the young man starts to think about that, and he says, "Well, when somebody praises me, I feel good. And actually, when somebody insults me, I don't feel so good. I feel pain. But I don't feel like I want to take revenge on the one who insults me. So I think I've achieved equanimity." And the master looks at him and says, No, you haven't achieved equanimity yet. Go back. And when you can, when your concentration doesn't waver, no matter whether you're praised or insulted, then you've achieved real equanimity. And I always thought, when I first read that story, that that was the teaching. But what I think now is something slightly different, which is that it's equanimity is put up in that teaching story as something that has to be perfected. And it's true that most of the enlightened beings that I've encountered did have a very, very wide stream of equanimity that was palpable. But for me, equanimity is arrived at through the process of awakening, and it's arrived at through our very fractured and imperfect selves. So we don't want to throw that out and not attend the mystical school because we haven't achieved equanimity yet. It's actually part and parcel of how we open up to the awakened state, to mystical states. And that's really an important distinction. It speaks to that place of healing, being okay, and being okay, it's okay to approach the mystery with our imperfections, you know, that we're not completely healed. And in fact, most of us won't even start looking for the source until we're suffering in some way that we can't get out of, and we have to pray to something higher or find something bigger to hold us. So suffering, in that sense, is what potentially can bring us to the state of equanimity. I'm following that. Any questions? So the Kabbalists speak about arriving at the state of equanimity through a series of union with opposite qualities, and that's what's present in the Tree of Life. It's kind of like electricity, which is produced through two poles. When you have those two poles, there is electricity present. And with us, when we can hold two opposite poles without shattering, which means without shattering our nervous systems, we actually are stretched, or our nervous system is stretched to have the capacity to channel the light through our system. And it's the channeling of the light through our system that literally awakens us. And that's where it's very much parallel to the Kundalini process. When the Kundalini rises, and awakens the centers in the body, light is channeled, literally channeled through the system. And that's just the start of the awakening process. That's the start of a purification process so that we can be more and more open to receive. So let's look at the tree for a minute. On my tree, I've colored groups of circles. Each of these circles is a sphira or spherot in plural. And sphira is a vessel. They're actually vessels of light. Another name for each of these circles, there's 10 of them, is a gate of light. There's sometimes, you have them on your sheet, but sometimes they're actually called bounded infinities. Bounded infinities, isn't that kind of nice?
We're like
that. You like that word.
Well, Chris, a circle is made of oppositions. You're speaking in opposite poles.
Right.
So a circle holds opposites in relation, in right relation to each other. What kind of infinity?
Bounded infinity.
Bounded infinity. I like speaking of the circle as the infinity of totality containing. And then outside of the circle is the infinity of endless expanse.
You're a Kabbalist already.
And consciousness is the place where those two infinities meet, which is the circle.
That's it. Yep. Yes. A couple of things to know about this tree. Oh, yeah?
I counted 11 circles.
Yes, I'll talk about that.
You said
good
10.
For you. I'll get to that when we're...
Sounds like a sphere?
Spherot. I think the root actually has its word, and it has a root in sapphire, which is related to book, but it's Hebrew for a vessel.
And that's a word that's spelled P-H.
I-R-O-T in English.
And you just don't pronounce the E, you just...
Sphirot. How would you say it, Haya?
Sphirot.
Or Sphira, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's my Hebrew reference. So yeah, there are 10, and I'll explain that in a minute. First thing to note, though, the top of the tree, Keter, usually called crown, is actually considered to be the roots. So in essence, above the tree is the, what did you call it, the all pervasive consciousness?
Infinite
consciousness. In Hebrew, it's called Ein Sof, the without end, nothingness. So this tree exists in the without end, nothingness. And its roots are in heaven, and its feet are the branches which are on earth. And this is considered first cause, and this is effect. And then you'll notice that there are three columns. And actually, in order to understand the left and the right, the tree is actually like on the back of a person. So when you're looking at it, the left column is the ones that are called Bina, Gevura, and Hud. That's left. And the right column starts with Chochmah, Hesed, and Netzach. And while I'm at it,
the figure has its back to us.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Many people don't know that and get very mixed up. And the two, there are numbers of ways to look at it. Most common are that there are three vertical columns. There's also horizontal columns. The two side pillars are male and female. And the male side is the Chochmah Hesed Netzach side. And this male side, the whole male column, is considered the outpouring energy, the energy that goes outwards. And in contrast, the whole female column is considered the containing column, the place, womb, holding column of the tree. And I use male and female because that's how they're traditionally spoken of in Kabbalah. But it's the principle of opposites, like yin and yang would be. You don't need to get caught on the gender here. But it is spoken about. The language of Kabbalah talks about successive unions of male and female, very sexually, mainly because in sexual union is where most people get as close to the unit of state as we can possibly know with our bodies. So they use this explicit sexual language. The middle column is the column that mediates the two side columns. So the middle column is balance and harmony all the way down with different stations and qualities. The 11th, am I going too fast? No, okay. The 11th sphira that is not ever mentioned, it's usually shown with a dotted line, is da'at. And I'll get to that as I explain. I'm going to go from the bottom to the top, and I'll explain why it's not usually included. Just have a sip. Before I describe the qualities and kind of like the quote stations of awakening, the whole tree itself is considered a ladder. And one can ascend the ladder or descend the ladder. From Keter to the ground, if you look at the attributes, it's a description of how God created our physical plane from nothing. So it's something from nothing. And it's like tracing reality from this nothingness all the way down into the dense physical plane. And if you look at it from an ascending matter, it's the journey of awakening. And the truth is we're doing both all the time. We're ascending and we're descending and we're spiraling around. And it's not really that linear, as far as I can tell, for anybody on the awakening process. As I talk about the qualities, each quality also has a, quote, good side and a shadow side. And in Hebrew, oneg and nega, two different words, have the same three letters. So oneg means delight, and nega means plague. And, you know, we're coming up to Passover, the holiday of Passover, where we dip our fingers in wine and we recite the plagues that plagued the Pharaoh in Egypt. And a plague is only something that's out of relationship with itself. So a frog is not a plague unless there are 20,000 frogs in your backyard. Then you are plagued by frogs. So in the same way, we can talk about the relationship of these qualities as oneg, delightful, or plagued, out of balance and out of relationship. And the funny thing about the two words in Hebrew is that they're spelled with the same three letters. And that means that there is an intimate mystical relationship between plague and delight, that one can turn into the other at any moment. Isn't that nice? The Kabbalists love to play with the letters of a word. And it gives you a hint also about awakening, that which is plagueful can be the actual grounds for your awakening in a flash. You just have to turn the wheel with the letters on it, or turn your perception of that. So, I knew I wouldn't read these, but they're just, it's my security blanket. let's start at the bottom with Malchut. Malchut is considered the physical world, and it's actually really the only sphere on the tree that's related to the physical plane. The rest are considered to be above the physical plane. And in our physical world, in terms of God awakening, God here seems to be very far away. We don't know where God is, and we have to do something to get to him or her. So what would we do to get to God from Malchut? We would pray, entreat God, plead with God, bargain with God. But God can't be seen here unless we've gone through a process. Usually the spiritual search, as I was saying before, starts right here with that sense of absence. You know, I have a feeling about a God that I'd like to know, but I don't know how to get there, and I don't know what it is. So we're bewildered in the unhealed Malchut state. When we go up the tree, right at the genitals and the hips, we have Hod, Netzach, and Yesod, and that forms a triangle that I've colored red. And at that stage of the awakening process, we start to deal with our sense of ego in Netzach. Netzach is the sense of I am, and that could also be positive or negative, depending on whether you have an inflated ego or a very unhealed and splintered ego. And it's intimately related across the body to Hud. And Hud is a sense of gratitude and gratefulness and surrender. What are we surrendering? The sense of inflated I. So the negative of Hud could also be submission, like negative submission. And when people think of God, from the Bible particularly, there's this myth of a punishing God that we submit to. That would need to be healed here to go further up the tree. True surrender is to something bigger and better than oneself. It's not submission, nor is it submission to any one person. Or God is made in the image of a person, like one's father or mother, you know, or school teacher. So Yesod is associated and is the mitigating quality between Netzach and Hud, and it's right at the genitals, and it symbolizes connection. It's essential connection to the life force. And the only way we can get out of the dilemma of grandiosity or worthlessness in its negative form to get to the positive form of positive sense of I am and positive sense of surrender is to have a real connection to God. So it's at Yes So that we start to long for connection, longing for connection to God. And it's considered to be parallel to the gate of sexual union as one of the first gates up the tree, this tree of light. Questions so far about that?
Yes, it's seeming to me it's like a Rubik's Cube in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That we kind of adjusted as we go along.
I think we get adjusted as we go along.
You talk about working. The idea of that we live in the bottom one, in the days, that we were upside down and inside out. And so the idea of that this is to turn this around, but I've heard that it's also turned up this way. And that all of these on the bottom serve the day's state. So our real awakening is not of this false ego that wants to be God conscious, but the one that serves the day's state, and waking up, wake that day's state up.
To wake the day's state up. Yeah, I would agree with that.
This is why it's so far apart. It's not because Earth is way down here, and we have these glorious other states are way up there. It's that we're the ones that has to do the waking.
Right.
And we're in this dazed, upside down, inside out state.
That's why it's useful for some people to have a kind of blueprint. It's comforting, actually.
So is that, like, my question would be then, is in your research, is that legitimate to move things around and redefine it for yourself to make it clear?
I would say it a little differently. I would say that by interacting with the blueprint, your own personal revelation happens. And I don't know if I would call it moving things around, but we are moved by that. We're transformed by it. There's no way you can interact with the tree of life and not be transformed by it, because it's an inherently alive hologram. And whether you believe in this hologram or another hologram, the property of a hologram is that wherever you enter it, you find wholeness. And that would be true about the tree of life. So if we move up to the second triad, you have Hesed, Gevura, and Tiferet. Hesed is loving kindness. Unending, emanating loving kindness. It's associated with water because it flows like water. It's always available to us. It's tempered by Gevura, and Gevura is known as judgment. And judgment is a restriction, and yet it's a divine quality. Now, why is that? Because somehow in this vision, kindness needs to be tempered by boundary and restraint. And one could relate to this if you've ever been smothered by a way too loving person, like where so much love is coming at you that you want to go, wait a minute, I can't find myself, I'm smothered by it. So that would be like love without a boundary. And on the other side, there are people that are held so tightly that the love from their hearts can't be expressed. They're bound. So that's how those two qualities work together. Gevura is also divine law, that there's a place that we encounter that really holds kind of the universal law of the laws of the universe that are fundamentally unchangeable in whatever tradition that you find, like thou shalt not kill, you know, those kind of laws. Fundamental law, fundamental justice. And they're mitigated in the middle by Tiferet. Tiferet is beauty and harmony. For me, that's where the equanimity word comes in. By the time you've been working with this triangle and this triangle and you get to Tiferet, you would be a being that can hold equanimity in most circumstances. And that's a very dynamic state. It means that you've worked with the ego consciousness, you've worked with grandiosity, you've worked with the struggle between boundaries and all-flowing, all-pervasive love. Some people in Christian Kabbalah equate Jesus with the state of Tiferet. So that's a pretty high state of awakening. It's the person that can stand in the middle of the crazy world and stay in equanimity and live that. You know, live an equanimity life, however you would put that. Live life in equanimity. It's not a lukewarm state. I also think of the Dalai Lama sometimes in that place. And I'm sure you could think of... Anybody think of someone Jewish in that state? I mean, the great Jewish sages like an Isaac Luria and the Baal Shem Tov.
You already mentioned him. The greatest Jewish...
Jesus was Jewish.
Right. Absolutely. And he was undoubtedly familiar with this, as well as Eastern teachings. But moving up the tree, we come to Dot. Dot is often talked about as the unseen sphera, and it's called knowledge. And it's the kind of knowledge that can't be found in any book. And in terms of awakening, my Kundalini teacher said it's the state when the light has risen to the third eye and doesn't descend any longer. Purification can still happen, but it's the state where you're awake enough to do your purification from the awakened state. And there's a kind of stabilization of your contact with something greater, a greater reality. That gets stabilized. And therefore, you can turn inwards towards yourself and do even deeper work healing primordial splits in your consciousness because of this stabilization. I think it's hidden because people don't talk, you know, people talk about the light hitting the third eye as being, you know, a very glorious opening, awakening, illumination happens, but it's not the end of the journey. It's actually really the beginning of a particular stage of awakening that then continues to blossom and open. I think a lot of people who have declared premature awakening and then fallen probably reached that state, but just hadn't finished the purification process, and stuff comes up, which explains a lot, for me anyway.
Is this a process that exists, everyone in this room is going to die someday, and if we're doing this and we're not complete with this, is there a kind of a limbo where you can continue to evolve in, a, say, another kind of body? Or?
As far as I know, and this is just on hearsay, we take the state of awakening with us into the next subtle body that forms the next physical body, so that the work we do will create different circumstances in another body. But as far as I know, and anybody can disagree with that, the subtle body, the patternings in the subtle body are what helps us incarnate into the next body, unless we're totally liberated, and we don't. So,
this Kabbalistic is, it believes in reincarnation?
They do. Yeah.
Because I don't think of the Jewish religion as...
It's in there in subtle form. I don't have the exact references. But it is in there. And there are longer talks and shorter references. So the rabbis, you know, the current teachers of it, we'll use a very short reference to make a long reference to reincarnation. Let's see. So we talk about Dot as a kind of unseen, hidden illumination. And when we get here, these three are the supernal three, and they're said, Chokhmah and Bina are often nicknamed mother and father. And this particular mother and father are said to be in constant union, like this, barely separable. And yet they're discernible enough to be called male and female. And Chokhmah would be called the level of wisdom where you don't have language for it yet. It's primordial wisdom. It's like the DNA of wisdom. It's like the pattern of wisdom. And language and understanding get birthed in Bina. So that primordial wisdom comes through and lands in Bina as language. When one is ascending the tree as a Kabbalistic mystic, the advanced practices were to derail the Bina mind, the intellectual understanding, literal mind, and go into Chokhmah consciousness. And Chokhmah consciousness was chaos. It was storm winds. It was losing one's bearings. And to be able to maintain a state of equanimity in a state of consciousness that feels like swirling winds, as Isaiah said in Ezekiel. So the practices that were considered dangerous were the ascent to this level of reality, because you really needed somebody to be with you. You needed to know how to come out of those states, those chaotic states. What I have also found in working with people is that when you have a major awakening or opening, one's deepest fear of annihilation comes up in this area. This is the area where the two go to the one. And that's where the sense of self is finally annihilated. So the corresponding personal work, it sometimes looks like you're going backwards into your deepest wounding. because it's actually some of the most painful work, and it relates to birth process, because we were birthed from the nothing into the something. And if you had a traumatic birth, the birthing wounds come up here. So I'm talking on a number of different levels at once. I hope that's understandable. It's like the parallel path between healing the personal wounds and awakening to the real unit of state that doesn't ever go away. And this triangle also represents very subtle processes that happen in brain physiology. As your brain is actually stretched by the light to fully become illuminated. And when the brain becomes illuminated, certain powers appear, the siddhis in yogic terminology. And this part of the path is fraught with danger, because once again, you might fall down to the netzachud area of abuse of power, which frequently happens. So particularly as one ascends, one wants to have company and a teacher or somebody to help you with discernment. That's a lot said. Questions about that?
Is that a little bit like the consciousness subconscious?
Yeah, but I find the subconscious all over the tree. That each of these, like the shadow aspect of each of the sphera, has a subconscious aspect.
It's sort of left brain, right brain kind of.
It is left brain, life, yeah. Right brain. That would be true. It's associated with the left and right brains. And then, you know, funny enough, so let's say you have an experience of illumination of the crown. There's still a stabilization process. And what you were talking about, what is your name?
Lloyd.
There's a Kabbalistic phrase, it's called making the creator sit on his base. And that's basically what you were talking about. So we achieve this, quote, awakened state. Now we want to make the creator come and sit on his base by embodying that in our lives. And, you know, this is an extraordinarily relational system. And if any one part of this system is out of relationship, since there are all these paths, something else is going to be out of relationship. So making the creator sit on his base is carrying that illumination into your daily life and allowing all our relationships to be permeated by it. You know, not skipping steps and not staying in the transcendent state. The Kabbalists talk about raising the sparks, that every single person has a unique task to raise sparks and return them to the crown in the sense. For me, it's about when every single person makes the creator sit on his base, we will embody that uniquely and differently. And the light then starts to just shine through your unique soul. And people can feel that. And you start to express your soul's purpose. The Jewish path is about embodying it here. So once we have it, once we have a sense of having traced these paths and embodied them, we live them. And we share that in a relational matrix in community, which I really like. What else? Questions?
It's interesting that they do not have a monastic. You know, you don't have to go into seclusion or be a hermit or go into a monastery in order to do that work.
Right.
You actually bring it back down into everyday life.
And it was an injunction actually to have a family so that you were kind of kept grounded. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. sexual relationships were sanctified. That you were supposed to have relations with your mate on the Shabbat when the most light, the gate of the most light was opened. Because you would sanctify the relationship and actually pull light into the union. Which is beautiful. It's kind of a lot like Tantra in principle. And it kept you honest. You know, if you had a wife or a partner, they keep, you know, intimacy keeps you honest. As we all know. Any other questions?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, if I'm going around saying, you know, I'm done, and my mate says, yeah, right. I saw you lose it this morning. What kind of state of equanimity were you talking about? You know, and children, raising children. But, you know, I'm not married, and I'm in relationship with loads of people that keep me honest. And you know, today, instead of priests, we use therapy to keep us honest and to continue the inquiry. It's almost like therapists have become the priests of our current times. That's what I mean.
According to what you're saying here, Tara, in relationships, we're having many relationships, sexual. Mm-hmm. Does that corrupt this? Enhance it?
Would be very individual. You know, if you get locked down on the law is going to say one thing, right? Do it this way. When I work with people, I have a process of inquiry in the healing process that helps us discover, like, what's the purpose of many relationships. We would look at Yesod, for instance, which wants to connect to everything. Yesod is the sexual drive. Why does it want to connect to more versus one? And in exploring that, we would find ourselves all over the tree. There's no one answer. There's a personal and unique answer. And in the exploration, you'll find out things about yourself. That's all I would say.
To add to that, in the 60s, there was this, we're all sleeping around with each other. And when people had trouble, when there were people that had trouble with it, men and women, the partner that had another partner would say, which was the common phrase to say at the time, was that you were possessive,
mm-hmm,
and envious. In other words, the person...
The person who was jealous or something.
Yes, it was their fault.
Mm-hmm.
And this is it was never resolved. As many situations I've seen, it would come up either a very laissez-faire thing where it's just, oh yeah, we'll just have many partners, and then there was this difficulty where I don't know which one here would be the center we're talking about.
Well,
emotional possessiveness.
Right. So if we were going to have a longer private conversation, I don't want to go into your whole history, but we could start talking about, like, Chesed and Gevurah, for instance. Does loving kindness need the right... What is the right kind of boundary for loving kindness to feel safe? And everybody will answer that differently according to their history. So actually, I thought I would try a little exercise with all of you around that. Let's see how we're going to do this. So Chesed is unbounded loving kindness and has the feeling of flowing like water. So for a moment, close your eyes and see if you can find a memory or an association that brings up a body sensation for you. The body sensation is the important part of just streaming Chesed, streaming loving kindness, and what that would feel like for you in your bodies. You're receiving the emanation of Chesed, which is streaming, flowing like water, loving kindness. Okay. Can I get a couple of, can I check in and I'd like to hear a variety of what that feels like without censoring. And I'm saying that for a purpose. So just call out what is unlimited unkindness, unlimited kindness feel like.
Pleasure. Continual flow in a circle.
Pleasure, a continual flow,
Mind,
sweet.
Openness.
Open.
Connection.
Connection. Did anybody feel resistance anywhere in their being to that? Oh, can you speak to the resistance a little bit? It's important. It's really important.
Well, I was going to say abundance, but that was after I was noticing there was resistance to, oh, is it okay to feel this happy or accept the good that this moment has?
Right. Is it okay to receive the good, feel this happy? Did anybody feel like they, yours?
I have one. I'm floating in water and it's, I'm held up with the water and I'm feeling the water all around me and it's so wonderful and it's endless. And then I sense that there's a waterfall ahead. And I become very frightened about, you know, how much of that can I take?
Exactly. So Oneg Hesed would start to go into Nega Hesed if it got to be like a waterfall, and you're going to go down Niagara Falls, and terror comes up, right? Mm-hmm. All of the comments are deeply embedded in our conditioning from our childhood. Let's try the opposite for a moment. So Gevura is restraint. One Gevura, good Gevura, could feel like being held or wrapped in a blanket that was cashmere. Or it could be like having the right feeling of skin protection of your skin. It could be the good womb. It could be the right bedroom. You know, so Oneg Gevura is good container, and it has a containing quality. So let's see what happens. Close your eyes, and call up the sensation. It's also unlimited of good Gevura, Gevura that holds and contains you. Okay. You can open your eyes. So call out some words. What does that feel like?
Shelter.
Shelter.
Protection. It's nice, but it's restricted. I feel like inside an egg and I want to get out.
Okay, so there's your nega, Gevura. Who else felt restriction? Negative? Was there any point where it was good and then negative?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. Became the enantio dromanon.
What?
It turned into its opposite.
Uh-huh. Anybody from this side?
Auditory. It was a bell and knowing exactly how many sounds of the bell are going to happen.
Wow, you're a sound person. I've never heard an auditory description. Yeah. Did Hesed have a sound?
Yes.
What was the Hesed sound like?
Well, I was in the water also, like this woman over here, with the dolphins.
With the dolphins, great.
So, a lot of clicks and clacks and zooms.
It's my first auditory feedback on this. Here, then?
Easier than the Hesed.
Right.
More fuzzy and warm and safe.
So isn't it interesting that we have preference, right? And it's intimately connected to places inside of us where we've experienced either the oneg, the good, or the nega, bad version of these. Now I'd like you to try something else. Start with first, determine inside yourself the one you preferred. So say to yourself, I preferred Hesed or I preferred Gevurah, right? And bring back that feeling of the preferred one. And then see if, at the same time, you can establish a relationship with the good version of its opposite. So if you prefer Hesed, you'll feel soft, expansive, watery, and slowly start to bridge, like in the tree, a relational line of connection to some version of Gevurah that you can take. And if you preferred Gevurah, see if you can start to make a bridge to Hesed. And do this with your body senses feeling it and see what happens. You'll find it's hard to hold for any length of time, but before you open your eyes, feel the room. If you have any sensitivity, just feel the energy in the room. And then rest and open your eyes. So what happens?
Integration.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody feel a kind of like stretching in their system?
And then I felt nauseated.
And nauseated. So it's
right
a little too long.
At the edge of that. Yeah.
Right at the edge. The training in embodying Kabbalistic healing was to keep embodying the opposites until the stretching could be held in the hands. And then I transmit these rectified states based on talking with people to pinpoint where they are. And when you get it as a transmission, your body can just rest in the rectified state. And that produces healing because the body knows it as balance, basically. And it's like giving the tree the right soil. And then your roots can go deeper and you grow into a rectified pattern. It's not fixing anything. It's like giving the human being the right soil to rest in. Tell me some more about what you felt.
You know, it was actually harder than both of them individually.
Right.
The first image was of what is the first sight called?
Hesed or Gevurah?
Yeah, Hesed.
Hesed
was water and floating and feeling very expanded. The second image was being in a conch shell. mm-hmm. in a big watery substance. But then the conch shell had to become soft, and it was a little too hard at first, and then I made it all nice and great. But then going out of that nice, comfortable womb to the bigger water felt scarier than when I was in the bigger water without the oven.
Coming out was scarier. Okay.
Yeah.
And that would be a particular piece of work, I think. For me, when they come together, it would be like feeling water in the conch shell and feeling the conch shell in the ocean. Or as Michael was saying, it's almost like it's like either you're the air in the balloon or you're the balloon holding the air. Mm-hmm. But there's something about like two sides of a coin coming together, and it becomes one thing with practice.
Yeah.
So that there's no longer a discrete conch shell in the ocean. It's some union of these things into, like, heads and tails make coinness. So coinness is the union. It's neither heads nor tails. And the Kabbalists talk about that as being a greater state than either of the sides.
It became almost a contained boundlessness.
A bounded infinity.
Because, the heart was completely open with
right.
the chesed, and the other was this, so it's...
Exactly.
Truly an astonishing
point. Is it important to go through that process, though? I mean, from the nothingness to the point, and then from the point again? Is that important, that process? Or?
We're doing it, no matter what. We're born and we die. We don't have a choice about that. And it also happens to be the process of awakening as the, quote, small self dies to the large self, comes back to being in this bag of skin, limited but not limited. So that process is going on all the time. The thing is to be aware of it and to notice where we get stuck. Like when you find an exquisite revelation like that particular piece, we'd explore it because it's really interesting. It's a metaphor for something.
It is.
Yeah.
It's been an image of mine all my life.
There you go.
Talk about a metaphor. It seems very common that when women are describing inner states, to use liquid, mm-hmm. water. I've heard it before. And when men do it, it's fire. So it's like this, the two sides, the water and the fire. And then when you bring them together, you get a steamy situation.
You do indeed. And Hesed is associate. I forgot to say Gevurah is fire. You get light, actually. It depends on how you interpret that. But personally, I'm a fire girl and I'm a woman. I like the bounded side. You know, we all have our preferences, right?
Well, I'm a Pisces and I have water.
Your water,
mixes
right.
up a little bit.
Charlene?
That's part of the days that exist on that bottom one, is all this information starts to intermingle. And I think when you're slightly awakened, is when we do become prejudiced a little and say, this is what we're going to say, like what he said over here. What's his name again?
Michael.
That we do have these orbs that have to be clearly defined. And there may be protesters that might say, well, you know, well, this contradictory thing is also true. But the minute that starts, when someone says the contradictory thing, then everything crashes.
Well, it constellates this opposite until we know how to hold both.
Yeah.
Without polarizing.
Sometimes to get clarity, you have to be prejudiced.
Sometimes you do.
To hold the orb in shape.
Sometimes you do.
Everybody starts to say, well, mine is, water is mine, fire is mine, the earth is mine, and then you got a muddy mess. And someone has to, reach out of the mire and say, look, we're going this way, you like it or not, and that would be called a teacher.
Charlene?
Some of the terms I've heard is the union of the opposites, walk in between the pillars, walk in the middle path, between the columns. You know, if you look at your architecture, you have three or four steps, so you have your pillars. I guess you could also look at that as, in the Christian term, the mystical marriage.
And Jungian terms, the same thing.
Because there's all kinds of symbols around us every day that actually show what we're talking about. I used to work in electronics, and any kind of equipment. You have little sine waves, that come through and back and forth. And
It's just kind of right there.
The symbols abound, the caduceus, the medical symbol.
And I wanted to say something about the tree of life that was very interesting to me. I hadn't thought about it for a long, long time. But I did have a dream one time, and it was the tree. It was a tree. And I got so confused because I saw it at almost base level, but not kind of in the middle. And as I went up the tree, I thought I was going into the leaves and the branches, but it came roots. So that has been a really more of an explanation than I've had in probably 20 years to see the growth, as you were talking, the above and the below combination. In
right.
The right. Beauty. Thank you.
Any other comments about that process?
I didn't have water or fire. It was more space or air or energy, and so I had a big resistance to the initially to the kibbutz. So I thought
to the what?
To the kibbutz. I was
Gevurah, yeah.
Gevurah, sorry. And so I thought, well, take a big container. So I took the sky as my container and the earth, but I still felt contained.
Uh-huh.
A big, you know. So I couldn't feel the. Like you said, the positive side of it.
The positive side?
Yeah, a little bit, but then I still wanted to go.
You like the expansion better than the container. Right, right. So wherever we've had oppressive containers in our childhood, we'll have a reaction to anything too small for our big consciousness. Or we'll have a reaction to any kind of limitation. And yet the Tree of Life teaches us that we can't feel the full force of loving kindness unless it's channeled by the restraint of Gevurah, just like a hose channels water, you know? So it's really interesting to work with what really good container is and allow that to be patterned as something useful. And that's part of what the healing work is, you know, that I do with people. And it's not just there. Each of the pairs on the tree is a different healing, and we work vertically and horizontally. And eventually, you just keep spiraling deeper and deeper into past lives even. You know, you go right through the birth and into past lives. Because these issues are archetypal, and we carry them with us. So, yeah.
Could you expound a little bit on the association of fire with the left hand or female thing?
In one of the older texts, the Sefer Yetzirah, they talk about this tree being birthed through the four directions of above and below, and then the four directions associated with the elements. And then this is kind of like a flattened tree compared to that particular Kabbalistic text. So literally each of these spheres are an element through which the physical universe was birthed and created. So therefore they're associated with elements. And I don't know who made Gevurah fire, but its opposite is Hesed, you know, water. The associations are really old. I don't know. I think Sefer Yetzirah is the first text that has that association in it.
It's interesting that loving kindness is usually associated with a mother and a feminine, and
water.
Yet it's on the father and the masculine side in this
yeah.
Tree of life.
Yeah. Yeah, because they put the container side as a womb, which is another way to look at container.
You raise the big one. Is there a way of going with the ongoing classes that you give? We want
yeah,
to
thank you
it
for
further,
asking.
Because
yes.
This is really more of a tease than it is.
Yeah, it's only an hour and a half. I have a page there to sign up for further classes. I know I will be offering some things at Near Shalom, Congregation Near Shalom, which is in Katati, and I'll probably offer some more things either out of my home or somewhere in Sebastopol. I also designed a line of prayer shawls, which I'm wearing one. And these came out of Kabbalistic meditation practices. There's six designs, and I have cards about them and a website. And this one has all the names of God on it so that you can wrap yourself in the name and feel the vibration around you. In closing,
you know, I'd like to just say something about Danny's healing practice. I have been to her, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 times, and I never really knew how the container was held. I just knew that I really loved what she did, and I always left just feeling so much clearer. But I got understand tonight that what you were doing when what she would do is like she'd have me talk and a little bit, and then she'd be listening and sort of seeing with a bigger eye, and then bringing into the session the archetype or the energy of some part of the tree, whatever resonated with what I was saying. And then at some point I'd lay down, that's part of the session, and she'd very lightly touch me, and then be imparting that energy to me from, I guess, mm-hmm. from the tree. I never really knew that before tonight, but I'm telling you, it's wonderful, wonderful work, and it goes very deep, you know, for days afterwards there'd be just stuff that would come up. So I encourage you to experience Danny's healing work.
One last thing before I close. There is a basket for donations. Tonight I'm going to donate whatever part is my donation, the donations for me, to a teacher who's been really helpful to me that has 4th stage throat cancer and is finally getting some medical care in Colorado. So I just want you to know that that's where the donations are going. He really needs some help right now. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, no one has done to me.